This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and for the rest of the program today, we're going to be talking about how we, the people of Illinois, fund public education from early childhood through universities. For the earlier part of that range, from elementary schools, high schools, Illinois has dramatically increased funding in recent years. And this was part of a push to bring more equity to a system that had previously been based primarily on whether a school was in a wealthy community or one that was more impoverished. But for public universities, it's been a different story. Going back to the year 2000, Illinois dramatically reduced funding for higher education, and that's led to significant increases in tuition and more students having to finance their education through debt. All this is the subject of two reports, recent reports from the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. This is an independent, nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank. It's a group that I think would be fair to say has a center-left perspective, but in the 20 years I've been following their work, I've always found it to be intellectually honest and fact-based. You all can correct me if you want to take issue with any of that, but joining me now to talk more about this are Elaine Gaberick, a research associate at the center, and Ralph Martiri, the group's executive director. Elaine and Ralph, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having us on the program.
So, Elaine, I want to begin with you, and we can start with elementary and secondary education. Can you briefly remind us of how Illinois used to fund public education up until the year 2017?
Yeah, absolutely. So before the evidence-based funding formula went into effect in 2017, most public school districts were funded primarily from their local tax revenues. So this meant that in property wealthy districts, there was plenty of funding to go around, and in districts that did not have the same amount of property wealth, there was less so.
So you mentioned the evidence-based funding formula, EBF. Now there are a lot of technical changes. There's 34 points of analysis and different acronyms. I guess my challenge to you is, can you explain the evidence-based funding system to me like I'm a smart 13-year-old?
Okay. So basically what the Evidence-Based Funding for Student Success Act, or EBF, does is it takes a look at essentially two figures. So first would be the adequacy target. So this is the dollar amount that a school district needs to adequately service its students based on those 34 elements you talked about. Then the other figure would be that district's final resources, or the amount of funding from both local resources and any past year state appropriations. So from these figures, the EBF then calculates a percent of adequacy, which basically can be thought of as a percent that the district is funded. So note that federal dollars are not included in the equation. This is because 90% adequacy is considered to be fully funded. It assumes that any federal appropriations would get the districts to that 100% mark when those are taken into account.
Okay, and so I guess if I'm going to try and rephrase that, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but this is looks at how much you would ideally spend or adequately spend on students, how much money you're actually bringing in from your local property taxes, for example, and other funding sources, and see if the state can help make up the difference. Is that right?
Yes, that's essentially right. So we then take the percent of adequacy for each district, which then makes it fall into a certain tier. So there's four tiers. So any new tier funding or new money that the state is putting into the EBF will then get distributed primarily into tier one, which are those that are the farthest from their adequacy targets or have the least percent of funding, all the way up through tier four, which tier four are districts that are already at 100% and they therefore receive the smallest portion. So this is basically the state's way of determining how new funding will be appropriated each year, which takes into account the districts that have the greatest.
Okay, we have to take a break. Unfortunately, we're on a fixed clock on our program, so we will continue this conversation when we return. We are talking with Elaine Gaberick, and we're going to bring Ralph Martiri into our conversation. They are both with the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, which recently published two reports, one looking at the state's big change in the way it funds K-12 education here, and another looking at a significant drop in funding for higher education in the past few decades and how that has affected students here. If you want to join our conversation on these topics, 800-222-9455 is the number. That's 800-222-9455. More to come here on The 21st Show after a short break. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about education funding in Illinois based around two reports that recently came out from the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, a think tank that looks at how Illinois spends its money. We are talking about that with a research associate, Elaine Gaberick, from the center, and Ralph Martiri, the executive director of the center. 800-222-9455 to join our conversation today. That's 800-222-9455. All right, Ralph, I want to bring you into the conversation now. Before the break, we had sort of set up the big changes that the evidence-based funding model, or EBF, was supposed to bring to K-12 education funding in Illinois. Your group, you, Elaine, and you analyzed, what is it, the 851 public school districts in Illinois to look at how this did. Big picture, how is Illinois doing in meeting its goals of making more education funding more equitable and adequate across the state?
Now, if you're kicking that to me, I think the answer is pretty clear from the data. Illinois is doing a really good job of moving forward from where it was. And Elaine is far more diplomatic than I am. She's nice to elected officials. I'm going to call it what it was. The old system was a mess. We had a foundation system that tied school funding into nothing. And when I say nothing, I mean not one single cost of actually educating kids. And so the way we changed that by going to the evidence-based model was we now tie the amount of money taxpayers kick into funding the education of children to covering only the cost of those evidence-based practices, which research show actually enhance student achievement over time. So much better to fund what works. And the amount of funding that ultimately ends up being identified for each district, as Elaine said, the adequacy target for that district predicated on funding these evidence-based elements based on the unique demographics of the school district being served. So each school district gets an automatic adjustment in the amount of resources it receives predicated on its percentage of low-income kids, English learner kids, special need kids, et cetera. So we went from a formula based on nothing to a formula that, if it's fully funded, would adequately fund every school to provide the type of education the evidence indicates children who attend that school need to succeed academically. And that's a much better way to go. And we've really done a good job. I mean, since the evidence-based model has been in place, we've significantly reduced the per pupil funding gaps for every student who attends an underfunded school in the state, number one. But, you know, we had some structural imbalances based on race and based on income and based on English learner standard and based on ethnicity. And so while a typical white kid initially was facing a funding gap of, you know, just over $2,000 in change in per pupil in an underfunded school, your typical black or Latino kid was facing a funding gap of well over $3,700. That is now all closed, and the gaps are within a few hundred dollars of each other. And the state closed its overall adequacy gap between what the model indicated was needed statewide in the aggregate by $1.7 billion, and it's moving more and more toward an adequately funded system. We're not there yet. Elaine could tell you exactly when we'll get there. I forget this data point, but I know Elaine knows it. If we continue putting in 300 or 350 million more a year as we have been. But the bottom line is we've moved forward in every measurable metric you can move forward when you look at how the new money going in has actually been appropriated to school districts. We have fewer districts overall that are underfunded, that is, have less than 90% of the resources the evidence indicate they need, than when we started by over 100 districts, and we've seen tremendous progress over time.
And just to jump in really quick with that statistic, our models found that at $350 million new dollars into the EBF every year, it would take until 2034 to reach full funding.
Yeah, and that's the yeah. problem, because the statute does say that it's supposed to be fully funded by 2027. So that extra 7-year period means we lose close to a full generation of students to an underfunded system again. And Illinois can't afford to do better. We have a state economy that's over $1 trillion with a T, and that's the fifth largest economy of any state in America. But really, if we're an independent country, that's like the 19th or 20th largest economy in the world. So we really do have the capacity to make this investment in our kids, and making this investment in our kids makes all the economic sense in the world. So it's something we should figure out to do sooner than later.
I do want to make sure we leave enough time to talk about the higher education report as well, but sticking with this K-12 report. So when you say you're looking at the data and there have been improvements across the board, you're talking about funding levels. At what point, or is it even fair to say, will we see outcomes, right? Students with either, however you want to measure that, college readiness or test scores. Go ahead. Yeah.
Brian, it absolutely is fair, and that's exactly what we're looking for. Now, here's the problem. We have an underfunded system, and so we need to get to full funding to really drive statistically meaningful deltas, or changes, I should say, in student achievement. We are seeing some enhanced student achievement. Now, we did have a pandemic for a couple of years of the 6-year lifespan of the EBF, and certainly the pandemic created learning loss across America, irrespective of the new resources going in. And number two, you know, when the evidence-based funding model passed, Brian, we had over 66% of the school districts in Illinois deficit spending. So a lot of the new money coming in, these districts really couldn't immediately apply to funding these evidence-based practices identified in the model, but instead had a backfill operation cost that they were borrowing to spend, which is sort of a worse fiscal practice.
All right, let's in the time we have, about 8 minutes left in the show, and it's not enough time, of course. We probably could have spent an entire hour on these reports, but let's talk about this higher education funding report. And Elaine, maybe you can just briefly tell us, the report kind of starts in the year 2000, which is when education funding sort of reached a high watermark here in Illinois for higher education. What happened to change that so dramatically over the coming decades?
So our higher ed report, as you pointed out, points out that the, you know, general fund disinvestment by our state in higher education has really contributed to this rise in unaffordable student debt. So you're right. It starts in like the early 2000s. We see that the shift in university revenue by source starts, you know, in fiscal year 2003, when universities were relying mostly on state appropriations to the point of about 75% of their revenue, to relying mostly on the university income funds, which is tuition or fees. So on average, the Illinois universities went from receiving about 1/4 of their revenue from tuition to about 65% of their revenue coming from tuition in fiscal year 2022.
And your report basically says that has meant more students are paying higher tuition rates, more students are taking on debt. Talk about which students in particular are affected by this, or affected most, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. So because tuition has had to increase so much, that means that college tuition in Illinois has on average increased by 121% since the fiscal year 2000. So nationally, this figure is at 71%. So while this is a nationwide issue, it's especially true in Illinois. And the types of students that this affects the most are going to be your low-income students, your Black students, your Latino students. Our report highlights that the average 4-year public university tuition in Illinois comprises of 1/3 of the median income for Black households in Illinois. So it very much becomes a race issue when tuition has to increase so much.
Ralph, the report says that, you know, if you adjust the 2000 state contribution to education operations for inflation, it's less now than it was now, 24 years later, than it was then. There have been times when even just using real dollars, Illinois was putting less money in than it was in 2000 without even having to adjust for inflation. What do you attribute to that? Why have, I mean, I guess there's one way you can say it, as Illinois lawmakers have abandoned higher education as something they think it's their responsibility to fund in Illinois. What is your perspective on that?
It's real simple. You know, we analyze the state's fiscal condition every single year. And what we see and what we've seen for decades now is the state has a true textbook structural deficit. A structural deficit just means that if you start with an honestly balanced budget in the year you're going to project forward from, and Illinois has not had an honestly balanced budget since I've been doing this work. They're getting a lot closer, but they haven't had one. Well, your revenues or expenditures are truly equal to each other, and you don't have any unpaid bills, et cetera. And then you adjust simply for historic rates of inflation and changes in population. You assume no changes in law, so you're just going to fund the same services tomorrow that you fund today. Your revenue growth is not sufficient to continue to fund the same level of services over time and pay your debt load. Now, that's where Illinois has been for generations. And so because they've had the structural deficit, we've had a number of bad things happen. Elaine highlighted one of them at the very beginning of our conversation today. State decided to kick the primary obligation for funding K-12 education away from state-based resources and down to local resources, so much so that even with the EBF putting this new money in over the last 5 or 6 years that it's put in, Illinois still ranks 50th in the nation in the portion, that is the percentage of K-12 funding covered by state-based resources, and number one in reliance on property taxes, and it's not even close. Second thing that we did was we underfunded our pensions. We just wrote an IOU to the pension system saying, you know what, we'll pay that back someday, take the money we should be putting to the pensions and cover up the structural imbalance. And the third thing they did was they said, hey, let's stop funding higher ed because they have another revenue source available to them. It's called tuition. And that's a lousy decision from a policy standpoint, and it makes college unaffordable for so many families. But it's a decision that a state that was in a very poor fiscal condition made. So bad finances certainly lead to bad judgment when it comes to policy decisions. And we've seen that play out in Illinois.
And there's so much more to get into here that we just don't have time to. And pensions, I'm glad you mentioned that, because there are people out there, and I should at least acknowledge that, that will say, yes, money to higher education operations has gone down, but money going to the state university retirement system, which, full disclosure, because our producing station is part of the U of I, and I'm an employee of the U of I, I am a member of the state university retirement system, that a lot of that money that could have been going to operations has been going up to make for these past shortfalls of the pension system. I guess I'd like to end on a more big picture or optimistic or forward-looking note. Take it where you will, and maybe it's not optimistic, but what are some of the changes that lawmakers should be considering looking ahead with, because we are in the midst of a budgeting process for our next fiscal year right now. And Ralph, I'll begin with you.
Well, when it comes to higher education, you know, there's a commission that just released a report that suggested a formula that would be evidence-based to use for funding higher ed. It identified that our current shortfall is at least $1.4 billion when you look at what the evidence indicates universities, and this is just for funding universities, it doesn't include community colleges, what universities would need to have an adequate amount of resources to educate the students coming through and to diversify the student population attending our public institutions of higher learning so that it looks more like the state. And that diversification, getting more traditionally underrepresented students into higher education, is really a great idea and something that the data indicates is sorely needed in Illinois. When you look at higher ed graduation rates by race, you see that only 37% of Blacks who enter public universities or universities generally end up graduating within 5 years, but 70% of whites do. And we have a significantly lesser percentage of Blacks coming out of high school, even matriculating in higher ed, than we do whites. So getting more traditionally underrepresented students into higher ed would be a great thing. And it'd be a great thing for the entire state if you just want to talk about simple economics. I mean, in 1979, someone who graduated with a BA or more earned 38% more than a someone with just a high school diploma. By 2022, that had jumped to 85% more. The Federal Reserve of New York just released a study showing that median wages for those in the early working cohort, ages 22 to 27, for a BA was $52,000 a year, but for a high school grad, only $30,000. That $22,000 differential on average is the greatest differential in earnings that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York has ever seen or observed since it's been looking at this. And we actually get a tremendous return on investment from putting this money into higher ed. For every taxpayer dollar invested, depending on which multiplier you use, we get a private sector economic impact of up to $3 per dollar invested. So for 1.4 billion, that would generate 4.2 in economic activity. So it makes sense for the state's economy. It makes sense for our people. It makes sense from a social and economic justice standpoint. And now we have an evidence-based recommendation that will work nicely with the evidence-based formula we have at K-12.
And we will have to leave it there. Ralph Martiri and Elaine Gaborik from the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, thank you so much for being with us today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey.